Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at fff.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and introducing the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer. He writes for the American Conservative Magazine and also for antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How's things?
Okay, Scott.
Well, good. I appreciate you joining us here. And now, listen, it's next Wednesday, I believe, correct? You have a big anti-Islamophobia thing, another great panel in Washington, D.C. about Islamophobia and specifically Christian Zionism. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's next Wednesday. It's at noon to 3 o'clock at the National Press Club, which is downtown near the Capitol. And we've got some good speakers who are going to speak on various aspects of Christian Zionism and also the impact of Christian Zionism on politics, which in many ways translates into an acceptance of what we would call Islamophobia, the designation of Muslims as the other in American politics and American society, as the immutable enemy. So that's what we're going to be talking about, and we welcome listeners of your radio broadcast to drop by if they're in the Washington area, and we're going to allow plenty of time for questions.
Great. Yeah, I sure hope that people will do that. Again, it's at the National Press Club. 529 14th Street in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., next Wednesday at 12:15. Well, that sucks. Right in the middle of my show, Phil, but okay. No. let's see. So you'll have you'll be giving a talk, and then also our good friend John Basil Utley will be there, son of the great Frieda Utley.
Norton Mivinsky, who's the professor emeritus from University of Connecticut, and Fuad Shaban, who was a professor affiliated with universities in Jordan and Syria.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, let's save the Islamophobia part for just a second. Let me ask you a little bit, you know, could you give us a preview of your talk, maybe explain a little bit about Christian Zionism and what this really means, maybe what percentage of Protestant Christians, you know, fall into this category, et cetera?
Yeah, well, it's hard to come up with solid numbers. I've just been trying to do that today. There are probably something like 30 to 40 million Protestants in the United States who refer to themselves as evangelicals. That generally means that they embrace a whole series of conservative mindsets in terms of the authenticity of the Bible as the source of all truth and so on and so forth, and other conservative positions. Socially. As to who the Christian Zionists are, they're a little bit different. The Christian Zionists are, of course, evangelicals, but they essentially believe that the second coming of Christ is imminent, that the second coming, as outlined in the book of Revelations, requires certain conditions to take place before them, and one of the conditions is the return of the Jews to historic Israel, historic Judea. And so that means essentially that they have a political agenda, that they support 100% and uncritically, absolutely, completely, the Israeli government and whatever the Israeli government does. It doesn't make any difference if they're burning Arabs in the public square. That's okay. They're really that extreme on the issue of Israel because, as they see it, Israel is a precursor for the second coming of Christ, so it's got to be supported. And that's essentially the way they look at it. So the danger here is obvious that this is a very highly organized. There are numerous in certain states, the Bible Belt states. They have good entree to congressmen. They work as a lobby. They raise money. They bring out people during political campaigns to go around and knock on doors. So they're pushing essentially a one issue in terms of foreign policy, which is support of Israel. And this has had obvious consequences. I won't say they're the only component of the Israel lobby. That's far from being true. But they certainly are a powerful element that is driving our policies in the Middle East.
So I guess, you know, in other words, what you're saying, no matter what Israel does, it's all part of God's plan, basically, is the theory, as long as, you know, there's some kind of reference in what Daniel or Revelations to Israel will be created again, then however many, 50 years after that, doesn't matter that the time has come and gone, right? Somewhere right around 50 years after that, that means Jesus is due to come back any time now. And all actual facts from the real planet Earth that we live on are completely subordinated to this religious belief, basically, is what you're telling
me. Yeah. Basically, they're anticipating the end of the world. And at the end of the world, it doesn't matter because all the believers, which of course is, they are the believers, are going to be wafted up to heaven, and the rest of us are going to go to hell. And one of the real ironies of this, of course, is the fact that the Jews themselves will not be wafted up into heaven unless they convert. And so the whole, shall we say, philosophy behind this love of Israel is rather flawed in a way. And the Israeli government, of course, is very, very cooperative with the Christian Zionists for obvious political reasons, but they must be holding their noses while they're doing it.
Well, now I'm sure you saw this thing that broke, late last week about... I don't know how prominent he is, but there's an Israeli politician, I think from the Likud party, who was giving a talk in Florida to some Christian Zionists and was saying, yeah, what we want to do is we want to blow up the Dome of the Rock and build the third temple there and invite all of you Christians to come and pray. He said, we don't want you to convert to Judaism. That's not what we're about. We want you to come and pray, and then he was leading them to believe, oh, yeah, and then your Jesus will come back, and I'm buying that. And I just thought it was kind of funny in a way because you could tell what a liar the guy was and how cynical he was and how he didn't believe what he was saying. He was just manipulating these rubes from the Florida panhandle somewhere.
Yeah, that's of course the way the game is played, and it's quite ridiculous because it's not in the interest of the Israelis to support this brand of theology. I mean, far from it. And but yet there's a political advantage to support a group that gives of 30 million activists that gives uncritical support to whatever Israel wants to do. So that's the name of the game.
And then also, as you say, these people, they sort of seem to be like the cutting edge on whether they mean to be or not. They really are what legitimizes, because there's so many of them, they have such power numbers, more than even government employees in this country, where they get to normalize this new racism or this new bigotry against Muslims, particularly Arabs. But, you know, it's not okay to be racist against little black girls who want to go to public school anymore, like they used to persecute. So now they have somebody new.
Yeah, well, that's it. And the interesting aspect of it, of course, is that, you know, this leads to a kind of racism, or an extension of racism, as you say. It probably was in the genetic makeup before. But the fact is that these people, dismiss Arabs as like they're nothing. I mean, they're non-people. And of course, the inbuilt irony in that is, of course, at one time, a lot of these Arabs were Christian, and there were thriving Christian communities throughout the Middle East, which have disappeared pretty much as a result of the kinds of policies that the Christian Zionists and others support.
Yeah. All right. Now, so what about the pushback? I mean, obviously, you're doing your best here, but. Aren't there a lot of people who really are past this kind of thing working on them anymore? I mean, there's a lot of it, but then again, it doesn't seem nearly as bad as McCarthyism got, right? Where you really were supposed to believe there was a commie under every bed.
Yeah, well, I don't know what these people believe because it's kind of hard to get inside their heads. I've heard a lot of them speak, and I think it's like if you really believe in a faith-based way what the Bible says and how they interpret the Bible in very strict terms, then, you know, you're kind of locked into this this kind of black and white view of the world, this Manichaean view of the world. And I think there, I certainly, when I lived in Texas, you're in Texas, I know now, I certainly encountered a lot of them. And I found them basically hateful people. If you're not exactly the same as them, you're not exactly seeing the world the same way as they do, then they have no time for you, and you're obviously not one of God's select, and you're going to wind up in hell. So it really doesn't matter. But both my wife and I had the same experience. We never found them people that were sympathetic in any way. There were people that you could actually talk to, or even talk to about Christian teachings. They're not interested in that kind of thing. They're interested in this second coming, which seemed to me is a fringe issue.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. I mean, their dear leader is this guy John Hagee from the Cornerstone Church down there in San Antonio, who likes to say things like the Pope is the devil and everybody follows him and they're all a satanic plot. And, of course, the Jews brought the Holocaust on themselves, he claimed. Max Blumenthal mm-hmm. called him out for that, and he just stuttered and stammered and pretended he never said it, but he's busted.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's some pretty hateful stuff, man. But anyway, all right. And then, so let's see. I wanted to ask you, too, about your latest thing at the American Conservative. Philip Giraldi. Oh, drone doubts at the CIA. A report on the post-Petraeus CIA and jihadist refugees in Turkey. Well, two very important subjects there. Let's start with the drones.
Well, I was trying to, you know, kind of reconstruct what direction the CIA might move in as a result of the change of leadership with Petraeus gone. And what I'm hearing is basically that there's a lot of dissatisfaction inside the agency with the drone policy, and this goes up really up to the highest levels. And people don't feel that it serves U.S. interests or that it works very well. And there's going to be a lot of pushback with a new leadership and new management at the agency in terms of getting out of these kinds of things, getting out of these programs. I'm not suggesting that they're going to go away, but I am suggesting that we might be moving into a phase where these things will be kind of de-emphasized.
Now, this is strange. I think this is the only place I've ever read, although you're referring to something you read somewhere else here, I guess. Brennan has privately criticized drone operations,
yeah,
stating they do more harm than good. Is that something that was reported,
yeah,
or that's something you know from your sources?
Well, I've heard it privately, but it also was reported in the New York Times.
Mm.
I don't remember what the article, it was a longer article, but it was about, I think it was the article where they were talking about how they're going to institutionalize counterterrorism policies. Somebody in the article mentioned, it was written by, I think, three journalists, and somebody obviously came up with information suggesting that Brenner was very reluctant to expand the drone program, and in fact felt it was counterproductive.
Hmm. Well, I mean, he's most famously known as the guy in charge of it, right?
Yeah, well, you know, but the fact is, when you get at that level of the bureaucracy, you support a policy, even if you don't agree with it. And it was interesting to me to see that maybe Brenner actually is not a total flunky, that maybe he does actually have independent views on these issues that might be construed as positive.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I guess we'll see. I could see how, I mean, assuming that it's true what the Washington Post says about what's happened to the analysis side of the CIA, that they're basically nothing but drone strike targeters now, I could see why they might resent that and want it to be the good old days again or whatever.
Well, and also the operations side, where I came out of the, you know, the operations side, we were the kings. We controlled the agency, and we were the spy handlers. And the fact is that they've been they've had their budgets cut. They're not very used. They don't conduct normal spying operations anymore. In most places, they just don't know how to do it anymore. So it's that kind of thing where all of a sudden there's, you get in a situation with a big bureaucracy, everything kind of goes along, and then all of a sudden something happens and you have pushback. And that's what I think we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Although, not that this really implies, even if these changes kind of go and the pushback is successful, it doesn't necessarily mean that the drone war will wind down at all, because you still got the Special Operations and the Joint Special Operations Command. They can still do whatever they want, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not suggesting for a second the drone war is going to wind down. I think I'm more suggesting that it's probably not going to be expanded.
Yeah, okay.
And it's something that obviously costs money. You know, they say, well, drones are cheap, but, you know, after you buy the drone, what do you do with it? You have to hire whole, you know, battalions of people to do the analysis, to collect the information, to maintain it, to set up a base. You know, it's incredibly expensive. Whereas, you know, running a classic espionage operation in out of an embassy in a city overseas is very cost effective.
Mm-hmm. Then again, they've got new jobs to do, right? I mean, you mentioned Texas before. North Mali is the size of Texas.
Yeah.
So that's going to take quite a few drones to cover that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is, you know, this is.
They need a whole new drone agency.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, and of course that is the problem with when you pump in the logistics to doing these sorts of things, it becomes incredibly expensive.
All right, now, so tell us all about the second piece of this, too. It's sort of this is a deep background, is it, or something else? I don't know. It's the American Conservative. Western intelligence agencies operating in Turkey and Jordan are alarmed at the massive security problem presented by the flood of refugees from Syria. Camps are ideal launching pads for terrorist groups. Do tell.
Well, they apparently have detected a number of people that they had already tagged as terrorists who had infiltrated into the refugees and were basically using the identifications of people who'd been killed inside Syria. And so, you know, since there are now huge refugee camps in almost all the adjacent countries, the question is how many of these people are basically setting up as terrorist cadres and getting their acts together under cover of being refugees. And so the partial solution to this is, of course, they're going crazy with biometrics and everything to try to identify who everyone is. But as this has demonstrated in Afghanistan, this doesn't work particularly well. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a hemorrhage.
Yeah. Well, now, tell me this. When the Obama administration put the al-Nusra suicide bomber brigade on the terrorist list, was that just for PR, or are they really trying to find someone else to do the fighting for them there? Because they've recognized the government that al-Nusra is the group that al-Nusra is fighting for as the legitimate government of Syria.
It's crazy. I think it just means that they really don't know who they're dealing with a lot of the time, and they're making gestures and trying to convince the interim government that they support that we're serious about, you know, getting all these bad guys out of the system. But I don't think there's any way they can do that. I don't think there's any way they're going to be effective.
Well, so. I don't know. How long do you think that the civil war in Syria is going to go on anyway? I mean, I guess Patrick Coburn says that the regime is still in charge of all the cities. But then again, the rebels have America on their side, right? So,
well, they've got America on their side that's getting increasingly cold feet about the whole issue. And the Turks were obviously the ones that were driving a lot of this, and they've got definitely cold feet on the one issue of Turkish support of the Syrian rebels. The Turkish public is I think in single digits. They're about 8% supportive of the policy. So you're going to see the Turks kind of pulling away from it. I think I've been hearing right from the beginning that the government is a lot stronger than people have been suggesting. And I still hear that. I think that basically Assad, if he wants to hang on, can hang on.
Mm. Well, I mean, the rebels have made it clear that anyone who resists them is going to suffer dearly, and so they've just given, you know, they don't really claim anymore, at least, to represent all the people of Syria or want what's best for them at all, which means that all the groups that are in the coalition that supports the dictatorship have all the more reason to support them even more, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, rather
that's exactly
than
right.
go
sure.
ahead and turn
sure.
on them.
Yeah, when you tell everybody we're going to kill you if we take over, I mean, it really has a stiffening of the backbone effect, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would seem to. But then again, I guess the status quo for the long term is okay, too, from the point of view of the Americans. I mean, it just means that as far as being, you know, a useful ally to Iran in any way, they're busy doing something else.
Well, yeah, but of course, if you go back to square one, you just have to say, to what extent was Syria ever a useful ally of Iran? Useful for what?
Yeah, I don't know. You tell me. You're the former CIA guy.
No, well, I think that there's too much of a tendency in Washington to kind of want to put things in boxes. And the fact is that, so what if Syria was an ally of Iran? It really, in real world terms, what did it mean? It didn't mean a whole lot. It meant maybe that some weapons were getting into hands of people we don't like in Lebanon.
Well, what about in the event of a war with Iran? The idea that the Syrians would then attack and...
Yeah, well, of course, but if you oppose the idea of a war with Iran, then none of that makes sense either, does it?
Well, no. But, I mean, if you were the Israelis or the Americans and you thought, well, eventually we're going to bomb Iran, we sure would like to weaken Syria as much as we can first, that would sort of make sense, right? Or, I don't know.
So
I could see them figuring that anyway.
It might, except that, you know, if I were the Israelis, I would want what's happened now, which is basically a Syria where it's very weakened and it's fighting internally. I mean, that's a perfect solution for the Israelis.
Yeah.
But for the United States, I don't see where it really benefits us in any way, particularly if it's going to have the effect of providing cover for terrorists, genuine terrorists. I'm saying not the usual brand that, you know, the way we call people terrorists, but I think that there are genuine terrorists, and obviously if they can infiltrate into this huge refugee stream, it could be a problem.
Yeah, I still remember Michael Shorter back in, 2004 or 5 or something, saying, oh, man, you invaded Iraq, you just gave al-Qaeda direct access to the Levant. You know, they had an entire Iran and Iraq in their way, and you just built them an escalator to northern Israel.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
All right. Well listen, we got to go because it's Mohammed Sahimi's turn, but I sure appreciate your time as always, Phil.
Okay, take care, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Read him at the American Conservative Magazine. That's AmericanConservativeMagazine.com and antiwar.com, of course. And check this out. You can find it on the blog at antiwar.com. You'll have to go back just a couple of pages. But it's called Christian Zionism and American Islamophobia. Giraldi Utley, January 30th in D.C. It's next Wednesday at the National Press Club, 529 14th Street. Wednesday, January the 30th, 2013 at 12:15 p.m. It's Phil Giraldi, John Basil Utley, Norton Mezvinsky, and Fuad Shaibin. All about Christian Zionism and Islamophobia in America. It should be great. I really hope that you will attend and maybe make a YouTube out of it for everybody later. You can read about that again at antiwar.com/blog.
Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writer MichaelSwanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.